You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
New York is often portrayed as a profane place, but the evidence of spirituality, conventional and otherwise, is everywhere, from church spires to yoga mats, from synagogues to 12-step meetings. And we are a city of seekers, a city of believers exploring multitudes of paths to the divine. Even so, John Sexton, the dynamic and controversial president of NYU, has found the sacred in a rather unusual place, the baseball stadium. His new book, Baseball is a Road to God, is based on a wildly popular course he teaches at NYU. It's published by Gotham Books, and I'm very pleased it brings John Sexton back to our show. Hello. And I should point out that although you are listed as the author, it says with Thomas Oliphant and Peter J. Schwartz. So what did they contribute?
Well, Peter was a student in the very first class that I taught, which grew out of an independent study. And since he took the course now over a decade ago, he's been pushing me to do the book. And then somewhere about 4 or 5 years ago, I changed the course to add to its normal menu, which was essentially readings about religion and novels about baseball. The last two classes, which focus on baseball in New York from 1941 to 1958. And I began to bring three friends to the class, Pete Hamill for his novel Snow in August, Tom for his book Praying for Gil Hodges, and Doris Kern Goodwin for her book Wait Till Next Year. And then the three of them, especially Tom and Doris, began to push me to do this. And the way Peter and Tom finally got me to do it is they said, give us time. We will sit down and have a conversation with a tape recorder. And of course, time is the most difficult thing for me to find. And then from those conversations, they would get my stories, and suddenly before me there'd be the stories written, and then I could begin to edit on planes. And that's the process we used.
You could have also have recorded classes, couldn't you?
Well, it turns out that they engaged in a bait and switch because, for example, take the first class. For the first class, the students have to read two books. They read Mircea Eliade's book, The Sacred and Profane.
He's the Romanian religious scholar, a bit controversial.
Yes, in his personal life.
Yeah.
But his scholarship is seen generally as being seminal within the phenomenology of religion. So the scholarship is not controversial. It's his personal life. And the other book they read for the first class is William Kinsella's book, The Iowa Baseball Confederacy, and they have to do a paper connecting the two. I just give them that. Just say, connect these two. Well, you can't do that with your reader. So they had baited me by saying to me, oh, you're just – it's the course, exactly what you just said. But it turned out that I had to completely reconceptualize it, and that was when I came up with this structure of the nine innings and the topics and working the typologies.
St. Francis Xavier said, give me a boy of seven and he's mine for life. Is the same thing true of baseball?
It is for most. Certainly,
most people are indoctrinated rather young.
Oh, for sure. There are some. My brother-in-law, who is a person who had a certain point in his life was a deep baseball fan, has been alienated by the excessive use of steroids and things of that sort, and he can't watch a game unless I'm there with him to coach him through it. But for most of us, it's undeniable. It gets you young. And I knew, for example, with my own son, who was baptized but later bar mitzvahed, that the choice of his team when he was born was more important than the choice of his religion, that the former would more likely stay with him, as you say, forever.
Unless the team, like the Dodgers or the Giants, leaves the city.
Yes, well, that, of course, especially for people who grew up with those three teams in New York instead of simply the one, now back to two. But when we grew up with the Dodgers in Brooklyn, frankly, it was unthinkable that they would leave. And I gave a speech, actually, at St. Louis University about 20 years ago where I said that most of the contemporary travails of America can be traced to 1958, because if the Dodgers could be taken from Brooklyn. There was no institution we could trust. It was only a matter of time before the government and the corporations and the church and it would fail us. And, of course, that today we have very little faith in our institutions, which is a sad thing.
And after that, there were no teams in Brooklyn until just this year. When the Mets came into the National League, they went to the Polo Grounds and eventually to Queens. Brooklyn has been the major loser, and as a Brooklynite, I've been very upset about that. The book starts with you and your friend Dougie on your knees holding onto a crucifix. What were you praying for?
So here it was, you know, year after year, we being the only two Dodger fans in our neighborhood, were subjected by kids, you know, you're a couple of years older than I, and some of them, even in our grade, were your age rather than ours, because some of them were toughs and had been left back. In those days, you got left back. And they would surround us, you know, in 1952 and 1953 against the gate, you know, in the playground, and they would say, admit it that Rizzuto's better than Reese, you know, that Berry's better than Campanella. And we were like the Christian martyrs, and they would pummel us, you know. So here it was this day, October the 4th, 1955, and we had, in those days, the World Series was played during the day. And usually when it came to the World Series, the nuns who taught us in St. Francis de Sales, right where the plane went down right after 9/11, the nuns in those days would let us listen to the radio because they didn't have radios in the convent. So they'd let you listen to the World Series from 1 o'clock to 3 o'clock. But we had, as a class, misbehaved, and our teacher, Sister St. James, would not allow us to listen to the radio. So we came out at 3 o'clock. We turned on these big transistor radios, and the Dodgers were up 7th inning, 2-0. And Dougie and I ran home. My house was the closer of the two, and we went down to my room in the basement. We took this crucifix, this metal crucifix of about 15 inches in height, down from the wall. We knelt by the radio, as you say, and we're praying and we're listening, we're praying and we're listening. And now it's the 9th inning, 2 out, and ground ball to Pee Wee Reese. He throws the ball to Gil Hodges, and the Dodgers have finally won the World Series. Wait till next year has now arrived, you know, and son of a gun, Dougie, let's go with a crucifix. And the head of Christ knocked off the top of my tooth, and for decades I wore that chipped tooth as a memento of the only time in history that the Brooklyn Dodgers would win the World Series.
Now, you prayed to a crucifix. Other kids were superstitious in other ways. They wore their hat a certain way, or they didn't change their socks, or they. I used to sit in a certain position until something went wrong, and then. And sometimes those positions would be rather painful, but it was important to make the sacrifice. What's the big difference between religious faith and superstition in regard to baseball? Baseball, a sport that has lots of superstitions.
Yes. Well, now, if you had asked me at the time, did it make a difference that Dougie and I prayed, I would have said yes. It was only later that I came to the view that prayer changes people, not things. So at the time, I was in the model of an anthropomorphized interventionist God. That's not the God of this book, as you know. What I try to point to in this book is the God of Tillich or Bonhoeffer, the God of Kung or Schillebeck, a God within that fits comfortably in the immanent religions of the East.
But since you were raised a Catholic, did the game ever remind you of Mass?
Well, it certainly, as a person who later got a PhD in religion and was schooled in the tradition of Rudolf Otto and Mircea Eliade, William James, I can see, and this book, I think, makes a case that you can use the tools of the phenomenology of religion to examine baseball, and yes, you find it there. So you find the equivalent of the Eucharist and so on.
Well, hasn't baseball been used in a lot of different ways? For example, I remember reading years ago a Freudian interpretation of baseball in which the pitcher was the mother, the catcher was the father, and the batter was the son trying to intercept the mother's love. Now, that makes as much sense as seeing this in religious terms and seeing the three bases as the Holy Trinity.
Yeah, so certainly, Leonard, I'm not trying to make an exclusive case about baseball. So I accept everything you just said.
Well, and people have said baseball is a metaphor for life.
Of course, and Gnostis and going home, all of this is true. What I'm trying to do in this book is, first of all, celebrate the wonderful capacity of baseball to inculcate in its fans, if they choose to have it inculcated, an appreciation of heightened sensitivity and the intense deep feeling and to connect that then to religion.
Are most of the students who enroll in this class fans of baseball?
Well, this is the first year in the 10 years that I've taught the class that I have a person in the class who actually played Major League Baseball. In the normal class...
Who is that?
His name is AC. He played 28 games for the Cubs last year. But
talk about a team that needs faith.
That well, it's true. And notice, he left it for NYU, so he's not playing this year. But in any case, half the students usually know nothing about baseball and half usually know nothing about religion. And it's a pretty interesting thing to try to introduce them to both topics.
And what's the male-female ratio?
This year, I think it's a majority female. It breaks one side or the other. Of course, the majority of students in college these days are female, and we usually break generally along that line.
Couldn't it be possible that the class is popular for some profane reasons as well? Doesn't it provide coveted access to the president of the university?
Your assumption that that's coveted is nice. I am generally available to students. I'm stopped maybe a couple of dozen times a day on the street as I walk campus and asked for a hug. It's kind of a tradition at school that if a student wants a hug.
Even these days?
Even these days. More these days because midterms are on. But I teach. I'm the only university president, I think, that teaches a full schedule. I teach four courses each year.
This and were you teaching before you became the president?
When I was dean of the law school, I also taught a full faculty schedule. I've been teaching for 52 years, and there's never been a semester when I haven't taught.
You include a lot of literature in this class. This is kind of like the Gallatin approach, where if you're teaching a music course, kids also have to read novels about music and things like that. You discuss a poem of John Updike's called "Dow in the Yankee Stadium Bleachers." Is it necessary to be in the bleachers to feel the Dow?
Well, you know, Updike's poem is a masterful piece. By the way, I have to compliment you because you've zeroed in without knowing it on an interesting part about the course. I had been teaching a seminar to freshmen on the religion clauses of the First Amendment for, I think it was about 10 years already, when I called the dean of the college, a dear friend of mine, and asked him if he would give me permission to teach a second course in the college. I had, at the time, two courses that I taught in the law school. I was still dean of the law school. And the second course was this course. And his first question to me was, well, in what department will it be? And I said to him, Matthew, I'm hanging up the phone and calling the dean of Gallatin. And this is, in fact, a Gallatin course. It's a course that I've loved to teach to this panoply of students.
But Gallatin is an untraditional school within the NYU group of schools.
And it emphasizes working across discipline.
My guest is John Sexton, president of New York University. He has served in that position since 2001. He has written Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game, with help from some input from Thomas Oliphant and Peter J. Schwartz, and a foreword by Doris Kearns Goodwin. It is published by Gotham Books. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us. We're back with John Sexton, the president of NYU, and also a man who teaches a number of courses there, including one about baseball as a road to God. That's the title of his new book, Seeing Beyond the Game. It is published by Gotham Books. Was Tug McGraw's "You Gotta Believe" an expression of religious faith in any way?
I don't think when Tug said it, it was a statement of religious faith, but I use that as a takeoff in the what I would say are twin chapters in the book on faith on the one hand and doubt on the other. And I think it is an example of the way this word faith comes into the conversation about baseball. I then take it other places.
Well, we mentioned earlier that people obviously choose a team. Do they choose a team, or is this like religion where you're born into a faith and unless you decide to convert to another religion or change teams, you pretty much stay with them the rest of your life?
Well, see, you've highlighted something which is one of the comparisons it's interesting to observe, and that is that both in the case of our religions and in the case of the sports teams for which we root, in this case baseball teams, we're more or less bequeathed them. They come to us. We then sometimes give them a place that causes us to begin to talk about us and them. And one of the things I'm trying to do in the course is by taking the tools of the study of religion and applying it to baseball and saying, look, you're a Met fan because you were born to a Met fan, or you're a Dodger fan because you're born to a Dodger fan. So also, and the students don't need the so also. They suddenly say, aha. And all of a sudden, they're thinking about religion differently.
Although I've met a lot of Yankees fans who are Yankees fans because they win all the time, which is different than having a parent who is a Yankees fan.
This is true, and there is this delightful character I have in the book. There are only two pictures in the book. The publisher insisted on a picture of me for the back cover, but the only picture that's inside the book is of this extraordinary man, Tippy, who's a friend of mine, a real Damon Runyon kind of character, who drives for a car service that we frequently use. And Tippy is a Cub fan, although he has no connection to the Cubs. But he believes that any team that has led the league in attendance several years with a last-place team deserves his fealty. So people choose for reasons, some of which are laudable, like Tippy's, others of which are deplorable, like the one you mentioned.
And people often talk about a curse affecting the Cubs. They talked about a curse affecting the Red Sox. I was grateful when the Red Sox finally won the World Series and got past that curse. But what happens when the curse is lifted? Does that confuse people about their faith?
Well, I could go on at length about this. I'll try to be brief. One of my favorite chapters is the chapter on blessings and curses. And I talk about the connection between the two, first of all. And there are many meanings of blessings I'm not using. What I use to define blessing is precisely the ecstatic release from deep accursedness. And you can respond differently to accursedness, and I think that affects how you process the blessing and being released, the question you've just asked. So we in Brooklyn felt cursed, but we responded with the virtue of hope. Wait till next year. On the other hand, and now this is a Yankee fan speaking, and worse yet, it's a Yankee fan who has relatives that live in Boston. The Red Sox, who, by the way, didn't discover their curse until the 1970s, even though it began with the sale of the Bambino, responded to their, quote, curse, close quote, with whining and almost one of the seven deadly sins, despair. So in 2004, when you say they were released, it wasn't enough. 1955 was enough for us. But 2004 was not enough for them. It was unrequited. And then 2007 wasn't enough. And then in 2011, they turned on their young. So this is the – now, that's not everyone. But you respond differently depending upon how you feel and experience the accursedness.
You would think that having had Ted Williams and Carl Yastrzemski and some others would have been enough. It doesn't – there are other pleasures that you get out of whether it's baseball or religion or any of an or the arts or whatever.
Well, and see here, the aforementioned Cubs, who, you know, whose fans respond to the curse the way you would expect a town that had named itself the Second City to respond, which is with a T-shirt that says, anybody can have a bad century. Or the even better T-shirt I found, what did Jesus say to the Cubs when he ascended into heaven? And the answer is, don't do anything till I get back.
Now, you mentioned a friend who had stopped following baseball because of steroids. Have we changed because, you know, one of the most awful people in the history of the world, Ty Cobb, was inducted into the Hall of Fame, I think the first year that they took people into the Hall of Fame. There have been a lot of other very disreputable characters there. But now we won't put Pete Rose into the Hall of Fame, despite the fact that he obviously is one of the greatest players that ever lived. And the whole steroid thing has tainted a lot of people. Have we become more moralistic?
Well, you know, this issue of saints and sinners in baseball is, as you say correctly, a difficult one. The sport has had sinners who've been great ball players, but they haven't sinned in relation to the game. So Cobb, who was despicable by every account, did not sin in relation to the game.
The other one is Cap Anson.
Yeah, well, there you could go right down. Even some of the owners and that have now been enshrined in the Hall of Fame could were part of the racism that did affect the game, but at least didn't break the rules of the game. Is the dichotomy I think that those that enshrined them as saints in the Hall of Fame would. But the thing about steroids or gambling, the Black Sox being the great example, but Rose being another, is that it gets to the integrity of the game.
My guest is John Sexton, who has written a book called Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game. It is published by Gotham Books. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Doubt is the antithesis of faith. And how does that fit into – I understand how it fits into religion. Even saints have talked about having had to overcome doubts. What about baseball?
Well, there's a way in which baseball incarnates doubt. I mean, baseball is, of course, a sport where failure is the norm.
Well, I doubt that the Mets are going to do very well this year.
Well, and that is part of what will bring the joy if they do. That's the Tug McGraw story, which is the opening of the chapter on faith. So this is how these notions are twinned, and they always have been. The issue of doubt is critical both in the area of religion and in baseball. And the connection that I make in the chapter on doubt is around the word hubris. And 'cause in religion, truth with a capital T, extra ecclesia nulla salus. You know, when a great progressive man said to me in a classroom in Brooklyn as he wore the Roman collar, extra ecclesia nulla salus. And I said, does that mean my best friend Jerry Epstein won't go to heaven? And he said, if you don't baptize him, he won't go to heaven. You know, wars have been fought over truth with a capital T. You know, so also hubris plays into baseball in many different ways. If you don't have doubt, if you don't have humility in confronting this sport where the most successful hitter succeeds 4 times out of 10, if you don't scout the opposing team as a pitcher, no matter how weak they seem, you will fail.
You talk about a gift that was sent to you by the New York Times when you became president of NYU. What was it, and what did the accompanying card say?
This is not to my credit. I don't mind telling the story, but you make me.
Well, you told it in the book.
I know, and I'm being a bit facetious, but this is. I'm going to confess, going in, not me at my best as president of a research university, but here we are. So they sent me this glove. Now they knew that on my academic gown I had a little circle with the number 42 in honor of Jackie Robinson. They knew that I had great joy that Rachel Robinson is a graduate of NYU. In fact, we bestowed an honorary degree upon her, a second degree. The card said, we're sending you, we went down into our archives and retrieved to send to you an original 1955 Jackie Robinson glove. Now, the language is ambiguous as to whether it's a glove that Robinson wore or it was some Jackie Robinson model glove. And I don't remember there being model gloves. There may well have been. I've deliberately not ascertained this. And I could have called the Times and asked for clarification. And usually, and this is where I say it doesn't speak well of me, those of us in the research university, if something is unknown but knowable, we want to know it. I chose not to.
Well, you could have had a DNA test.
Of course I could know it. That's the point.
And the Times has had an ambiguous relationship with you over the years as well. I hope that this book gets a better review than you got last Sunday in the paper in an article by Ariel Kaminer. You declined to speak to her. Would you like to respond to the article?
I didn't view last Sunday's article by Ariel as problematic. It speaks about a university where faculty feel free to criticize their president. I think that betokens, frankly, a healthy university. And there's an issue as to whether some of the faculty in one of our schools, the Faculty of Arts and Sciences, which is, I will say, the heart of a university, whether they have confidence in me. I have confidence in them.
Well, there'll be a confidence vote, won't there?
Our Faculty of Arts and Sciences has scheduled a vote this week as to whether they wish to express confidence in me or not. Other schools, the medical school, the dental school, the nursing school, were prompted by that to have votes that I'm happy to say were very positive. And we've kind of said to people, look, this isn't an election, but they will have the vote this week.
And what would be the consequences of the vote either way?
Well, I think the consequences of the vote for me, as this book reveals, I am a contemplative person. I know I'm not perfect. I'm always trying to be better. And I think when colleagues you respect offer you criticism, you want to listen carefully to them because you're more likely to find out places where you can improve by listening to them. And I have, and we've done many things as this year has gone on, as the conversation has gone on, and I will continue to do that.
Getting back to the course, you say it focuses on two words, ineffable, which we kind of talked about earlier in this conversation, and the noun hierophany?
Hierophany.
Hierophany.
Yes.
What's hierophany?
It comes from the Greek phanos, shining through, hieros, the sacred. And I'll give you one quick example. My family and I trekked through the outback of Australia, and suddenly in that flat land there emerges on the horizon and then gets larger and larger, Uluru, the great orange, especially if you hit it at sunset or sunrise, the great orange ball that we've all seen in the outback. And that is the sacred rock. And the baseball is the sacred rock, as the stadium is the sacred place.
Did you feel an affinity to Bart Giamatti, who was the president of Yale before he became baseball commissioner, and also saw connections between baseball and religion?
One of the great regrets of my life is that I never met Bart Giamatti. He's a hero of mine in so many dimensions, a great scholar, a great president, a great commissioner, and a great lover of baseball. And his book, Green Fields of the Mind, is one of the staples of my course.
Now, I can't let you go without telling you that we've been getting a lot of emails from our listeners, and they are angry about your relationship to God in the light of the expansion plan. Do you get a lot of emails?
I do all my own emails, and I get a lot of emails, but I'm hard-pressed to put our relation to God and our expansion plan together, except for
they're claiming that you're prevaricating.
Yes. Well, all I can say is that the role of a university president is to look, much as theologians do, over decades, and to try to do and enable the institutions with which we serve to do as much good in the world as possible. And the expansion plan was thought out based upon the needs of our faculty and our schools, and we do good in the world.
And one of the things pointed out in the Times article is that NYU has a smaller endowment than most of the comparable universities. So you have to go out there and raise funds in a way that others don't necessarily.
We are money deprived. We're also space deprived. One of the things that came out as we did space analysis was we're space deprived. So these two things are twinned as well, given our expansion plan.
John Sexton's book, written with Thomas Oliphant and Peter J. Schwartz, with a foreword by Doris Kearns Goodwin, is called Baseball as a Road to God, Seeing Beyond the Game. It is published by Gotham Books. And I thank you so much for coming here and talking with us about it. And good luck with the vote this week.
Thank you.
See you again.
Thank you very much. I look forward to seeing you again.